Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
In some ways, this Christmas 2013 letter from Switzerland picks up where the November letter left off. As it turned out, getting those new winter tires was timely, since a couple of days later, we had our first serious snowfall, and then another. Everything is white and temperatures have taken a nosedive. In fact, early this morning, the thermometer read minus 10 Celsius. And as the dog and I left the village at 750 meters and drove toward higher ground, where we take our morning walk, the temperature dropped further to minus 14. Driving up into the high woods to the north of us involves an element of risk in winter. Or we could also call it a gamble, since the narrow road up there is often covered with packed snow or ice, part of which goes through a steep wooded stretch, where road conditions are even worse. The ultimate nightmare is meeting another car coming down the road, and then working out who will back up. But somehow we usually make it, and the reward of the beautiful peace and quiet and the magnificent view of the high Alps makes it all worthwhile. In the past few days, I've also seen several deer up there. It's bright and sunny right now, and the nighttime sky looks like the ceiling of a planetarium. But this one is the real thing. In the past few days, the villages around here have put up their public Christmas decorations. In the middle of our village is a small traffic circle, in the center of which is a tall Christmas tree complete with lights, and cheerful lighted decorations are also hung from the street lamps. In recent years, lighted decorations on private houses have also become more and more popular, and they're being put up earlier and earlier, it seems. It's a cheerful sight in what is otherwise a dark landscape. Out here in the country, it's also the season for tree felling. Walking through the woods, you can find loads of pine branches and pine cones lying around, which are used to make traditional wreaths that are hung on doors and in homes. This costs nothing to make out here, but in town, it's a pricey boutique item. I'm writing this on December 1st, which is the first Sunday of Advent. Traditionally, a wreath containing four candles is placed in the home, and one candle at a time is lighted on the four Sundays of Advent. This is also the Sunday when many towns and villages begin Christmas markets, an old tradition in this part of the world where all kinds of seasonal food and handicrafts are offered by the local people. My daughter is a fabulous cake and sweets maker, and she'll have a small stand featuring some of her seasonal creations. In fact, my wife and I will be going along there this afternoon. And given this cold weather, we've decided to have a cheese fondue this evening in front of the fireplace. Whether or not we can expect a white Christmas this year is, as always, a matter of pure speculation. Having said that, the Emmental is one of those parts of Switzerland where the chances are good. We get snow early here, and we're among the last to get rid of it. Yes, this is an idyllic picture I've painted, but it's actually true, at least out here in the country. But there's certainly another side to this coin, and that was covered in my December letter from Switzerland last year, when I brought up the issue of greedy business practices and related them to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. On that score, I'm sorry to say that nothing has changed since then. In any case, this is the season when things tend to slow down, and people spend some quiet, quality time by themselves and with others. It's a magic time, which should really be the rule rather than the exception. I wish you and yours the maximum enjoyment and fulfillment from this most precious time of the year. Let's make the most of it.
Thank you. In addition to the newly produced material offered on the website and here on PCJ Media, we also feature some old vintage reports and features from the pre-Switzerland in Sound days. The information they contain may no longer be valid or up to date, but we present this material as a sound document for your listening pleasure.
If you ask the average person to name a few areas of science where active and widespread research work is going on, the chances are that they would not think of the word snow. As unlikely a subject for serious scientific investigation snow may seem at first glance, there is indeed a number of scientists working at highly specialized institutions, devoting all of their time to just that field. One of these institutions is located here in Switzerland. Snow is not only an important tourist attraction in this country, it's also been feared for centuries when it takes the form of avalanches. The White Death, as it's called, still takes the lives of an average of 25 people a year in Switzerland. No doubt, the figure would be much higher were it not for the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, which has contributed a great deal of knowledge about avalanches and other aspects of snow since its founding some 60 years ago. Let's put it this way. Snow is a simple, or maybe we should say not so simple, fact of life in this country, and that's reason enough that an institute devoted to its characteristics and behavior was founded. But the first determined talk about setting up such an institution came only in 1930. Until that time, avalanches had continued to terrorize mountain populations in the snowy season from autumn to spring. But finally, it was decided that it was high time to do something concrete, to devise some kind of protection against the White Death. But what exactly had to be done? What form should this protection take? The answer was simple. Before you can effectively protect yourself against something, you have to understand as much as you can about what it is you're protecting yourself against. Thus, the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research was started and got off to humble beginnings in 1935. Then, as now, it was located on the Weissflugjoch, a mountain perch overlooking the resort of Davos in southeastern Switzerland's Canton Graubünden. For more on the Institute's history, and one man in particular who was very much involved in it, here's Professor Marcel Dequevin, a former director of the Institute.
The man who then was in the field, the leading man, was Robert Heffeley. And I would say he can be called the founder of this institute. But it took a long time before he started to work with his colleagues in 1935 until the institute as such was established and built.
I believe the institute in the very beginning is hardly anything that resembles the institute today. I think it was a small shack made of tar paper or something like that.
That's right. It was a shack completely buried in snow, and this allowed to use it as a cold laboratory with more or less constant temperature due to the insulation by snow.
Things went on like that until the year 1942, when a permanent building was opened and staffed with full-time researchers. Today, the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research is a solid, stone and concrete science station manned the year round. It's full of equipment, and its work is divided into several sections, including weather, snow and avalanches, snow mechanics and avalanche formation, snow cover and vegetation, and the physics of snow and ice. In addition to pure research, the Institute provides a number of important practical services like advice on the proper placement of mountain transport facilities, the organization of snow and avalanche safety services, and of very great importance, regular avalanche warnings. Switzerland is a small country, but it still has an abundance of locations which would seem suitable for a snow and avalanche research institute. So I asked Professor Dequevin if there had been any good reasons for choosing Davos in particular.
I think there were a number of good reasons. We needed good snow coverage during the winter. Avalanches in the neighborhood, which can be observed, that's one thing. Then, not too far remote place with respect to cities like Zurich, universities, technical schools, and so on, so that we can bring up people within a short time to Davos, and finally the local transportation to the elevation we wanted to stay on, the 2,700 meters. We have the Parsen funicular, and at the very beginning they offered the free transportation for the institute and kept this promise. So it was decided that Davos would be a suitable place.
One of the key areas of interest in snow is its structure and composition, and the changes it undergoes from creation to destruction. This is the field of Dr. Walter Good. Let's start out with a simple question. How about a definition of snow?
Snow is formed in the atmosphere at a given temperature and at a given concentration of water. It is supercooled water between 0 and minus 40 degrees. That is the base for the formation of crystals. Already at the formation of the snow, you have a tremendous number of different crystal types. They are always more or less symmetric, but you have a very big number of different types. As soon as the snow is deposited on the ground, you have the interaction with the ground, mechanical interaction. So the crystals are destroyed partly by mechanical interaction and also undergo what you call the metamorphism. That is a continuous transformation from a given form to different other forms.
We know that there's a softer type of snow. There's another type of snow which packs very easily. Children love it because they make excellent snowmen and snowballs. What are the factors which determine the composition once the snow actually reaches the ground? What are the greatest influences there?
The humidity is the most important thing. But in winter, we have normally snow that is below 0 degrees, so it is not wet, it's just a dry snow. But even so, you can have different types because of the stratification of the snow. The stratification is given by the interaction of the falling snow and different other phenomena, for instance the wind. So you have not a homogeneous deposit, but you have stratified deposit of snow.
What, Dr. Good, are still some of the most important unanswered, or at least insufficiently answered, questions that involve our knowledge of snow, even today?
Today we would like to know when snow cover reaches instability, that is, the moment when avalanches can trigger. That is the most important question we are investigating, and we try to do that with these structural investigations.
Dr. Walter Good, proving that snow is not just child's play. Snow mechanics is a field of study pioneered by the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, and it concerns the behavior of snow under different conditions. How strong is a particular drift of snow? When will it become unstable, and why? Much of this research work is done within the Institute itself. Among other facilities are so-called cool rooms, where snow can be measured and observed under a wide range of simulated climatic conditions. Inside the cool room, I had a look at some of the hardware involved, together with snow mechanics specialist Dr. Bruno Salm.
Well, in the background we can hear cooling fans and various other things which are working. And around us, Dr. Salm, is a number of peculiar-looking types of apparatus, very scientific-looking. You might explain what is available here for experimentation and what you do with it.
Just here you see different apparatus for the testing of snow under different types of stress. Here, for instance, you have machine to test the tensile strength of snow. You put here in this cylinder a sample of snow, and then you rotate it. And it breaks when the rotation velocity reaches some amount, then the snow breaks, and then you can calculate from this rotation speed the strength of snow. This is a very simple method and very widely used.
I believe that some of these devices, Dr. Salm, were made right here at the Institute. This one looks, for example, like it was one of your own designs.
Yes, most of these things were made in our workshop.
The accurate calculation of snow behavior is by no means of purely theoretical interest. Such knowledge is very important to making reliable predictions of avalanche danger. Some people may find it difficult to understand why what appears to be a load of harmless, powdery snow can cause such extensive loss of life and property as it glides down a mountainside. Well, to straighten out any misconceptions of this type, Dr. Salm has a few impressive figures.
The avalanches can reach very, very high velocities. We know that the powder snow avalanches, airborne powder snow avalanches, can reach velocities up to maybe 300 kilometers per hour. We measure also avalanche impacts in nature, and the maximum we measured in Switzerland is over 100 tons per square meter.
Dr. Bruno Salm. Quite obviously, one of the best ways to avoid the devastating effects of avalanches is to keep the avalanche from even starting. And there are ways that this can be done. One of them is the placing of so-called avalanche fences in the high mountain areas where potentially dangerous accumulations of snow are common. In some cases, it may be necessary to build only a few of these structures. In others, whole lines at several different levels may be called for. Basically, these fences or barriers are only effective in the so-called starting zone. Should an avalanche actually occur, other measures can be taken in the pathway and runout zones where the avalanche finally dissipates. Michel Heimgartner is an engineer at the Snow and Avalanche Research Institute, and part of his job is designing effective snow retention and dispersion devices. Mr. Heimgartner and I crawled out a window at the Institute and onto an experimental fence of the type used to prevent snow accumulations from letting go. The fence in question was made of several horizontal steel bars placed a couple of feet apart. And as Mr. Heimgartner explains, this spacing is very important.
Actually, in our Swiss guidelines that are given to construct these, to design these steel structures, we fix a maximum distance of 30 centimeters between these bars. Now we make tests with distances of 10, 20, 30, and 40 centimeters to know what is the optimum of this distance.
What do you do to kill the movement, the motion of the avalanche as it goes down? What can be done there?
Then you have to control the direction of the avalanche. That is, you construct dams to give another direction to the avalanche.
Sort of steer it along, then?
Yes, that may be concrete dams, steel structures, or earth dams, generally. But that's the only possibility you have in the avalanche path, because there are the forces of and the velocity of the avalanche are too big.
Now, we have the expression, the runout zone, the area where the avalanche sort of comes to an end. What can be done there?
What we can do there is to shorten the runout of an avalanche, that is to stop it earlier. And also there we shorten this runout by dams, earth dams, to break the energy of an avalanche.
The construction of the kinds of structures we've just heard about is an expensive proposition. But fortunately, there are two other methods of reducing the risk of avalanche, which are far cheaper. One of them is the planting of trees. The growing of new forests in the avalanche starting zone is the subject of considerable research and experimentation at the Institute. The idea is simple, but effective. Instead of costly fencing, forests accomplish the same job of containing snow accumulations, that is, stopping the snow from piling up to the point where it lets go. The cost of this procedure is one-fifth of what it costs to build steel fencing. In addition, forests are natural structures and therefore more agreeable to environmentalists. On the other hand, it takes about 50 years for the trees to grow to an effective size. The other widely used method of reducing the risk of avalanche is also extremely inexpensive and very effective. And this method takes only a few seconds to achieve results. An explosion, followed by the crashing of hundreds of tons of ice and snow. This technique is given the name artificial avalanche release. What this amounts to is a kind of preventive medicine. In other words, you bring down a potential avalanche in a controlled way before it has a chance to run its own uncontrolled destructive path. This blowing up of potential avalanches is accomplished in several ways. For example, by throwing hand grenades, planting explosive charges, or even using bazookas or field artillery. But this procedure isn't all that simple. Dr. Hans-Ulrich Gubler is a specialist in artificial avalanche release. He told me that correct calculations have to be made in order to ensure safe and effective results. And this is one of the fields of study at the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research.
The problem is that you have to know something about the remaining risks after you try to start an avalanche, to trigger artificially an avalanche. And although you have to know something about the effective range of your charge, the possible effective range of your charge, and you have also to know something about the type of explosive you have to use. We perform measurements now. We measure the effect from explosives on the snow cover by measuring pressure waves and seismic waves in the snow, in the ground, in the air, originating pressure waves originating from detonating charges above and below the snow surface, different types of charges and so on. At the same time, we try to measure stability, the stability decrease in potential fracture zones, just to be able to give to the ski patrols some ideas how they have to emplace their charges, where they have to emplace their charges to get optimal effects.
That was Dr. Hans-Ulrich Gubler. All of the complicated work being done at the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research is of great importance. But probably one thing in particular is of most importance to the public at large. That is the Institute's daily snow and avalanche bulletin containing detailed information about snow conditions and avalanche danger all over Switzerland. The bulletin is broadcast every day over radio during the snow season and can also be heard by dialing the number 162 on the telephone.
Ein wesentlicher Anstieg der Temperaturen, kräftige Südwinde und mäßige Schneefälle in den südlichen Alpenregionen haben die Lawinengefahr verschärft.
The bulletin you just heard warned of increased avalanche danger. But the situation can change in a matter of hours, depending on prevailing weather conditions. Back at the Institute at Weissflugjoch, Davos, I talked with Dr. Paul Fern, one of the scientists responsible for compiling the avalanche bulletin. I asked him what weather factors were most conducive to avalanche formation.
Most important thing is the intensity of snowfall. If you have heavy snowfall and meters or 1 meter, 2, 3 meters of new snow piled up in 1, 2, 3 days in the Alps, then we get high avalanche danger. Whatever will be the temperature, whatever will be the wind, etc., this is a major factor for avalanching. Then the second important is, I would say, the wind. Then a third factor, that's the temperature, because snow grains have a certain temperature, environmental temperature. If the temperature changes, sometimes they lose contact, the grains, between themselves, and then we get so-called climax avalanches, which develop suddenly by a warming up in spring, for instance.
Well, Dr. Fern, there's another interesting aspect to this, and that is, of course, the actual prediction of avalanches. And here we get into a very complicated area requiring a lot of instrumentation and hardware. And I think if we go outside, we can have a look at some of the tools of the avalanche prediction trade. Well, Dr. Fern, we've come onto the roof of the Institute. Let's concern ourselves with some interesting-looking gadgets, if you'll excuse the expression. They look to me, two of them, like glass balls, actually. One looks like a sort of a globe of the Earth, but in glass. And the other one is a sort of like a lamp of some kind with a glass dome on it. And we have many other things. Dr. Fern, you might explain exactly what we are looking at and the function.
Instruments which record the weather elements as sunshine hours, that's what you call a glass ball, that's a so-called sunshine recorder where we measure how many hours of sunshine we have every day. Then we have radiation instruments where we measure how much calories we get on a level surface every day.
Calories, this is the measurement of heat?
Of heat, naturally. And we need all these measurements to know what influence is getting to the snow cover in terms of heat, in terms of wind, for instance, we have up there, we have the wind vane, we have the wind recording instruments.
But how can you possibly predict the avalanche risk for the entire alpine area of Switzerland from here in Davos? Surely the weather conditions must be quite different from place to place.
That's right. And therefore, we have, in every region, we have several such stations where other people measure for us every day the weather conditions, the snow cover conditions, and this information is then transmitted to us by telephone, telex, and we get every morning about information from 50 other stations, so we know quite well what happens in the other parts of Switzerland.
Dr. Paul Fern explaining the prediction of avalanches, an important but by no means only service performed by the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, located on the Weissfluh-Joch, overlooking the southeastern Swiss resort of Davos.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.